at the end of the day, people still want to invest. People still want to buy. So things are still doable.
Are you a real estate investor looking to sharpen your skills, or a newbie looking to become one? You're in the right place. Welcome to Where Should I Invest? Real Estate Investing in Canada with your host, Sarah Larby.
Hey guys, it's Sarah Larby here, and welcome back to my podcast, Where Should I Invest? All about real estate investing. And today we're going to be talking to my mortgage broker, Dahlia Barsoom, who's helped me save thousands and thousands of dollars and has worked with me to develop my goals. So she is a best-selling author. She writes a lot of articles in the Real Estate Wealth magazine. She's going to be a speaker at the Investor Forum, and she's done that for many years. So really, really excited to have her on the show. And she's going to share all her knowledge that she can about financing, being a mortgage broker, and what we should be aware of. There's a lot of new rule changes. And so there's a lot of questions that I asked her about different scenarios. And if you're self-employed, what are your options? If you're looking for a cottage, you know, what are your options? And the cottage piece was a little bit of a selfish question because I am currently looking for a recreational property in either the Kawarthas or around Muskoka or even potentially Port Dover area. And I've just been looking for the last couple months, thought it would be something to help diversify the portfolio, but ultimately it's also going to be a nice little vacation home for us. One of the things that I asked Dahlia was, what does the lending look like? And how does that differentiate from a residential primary residence? We actually placed an offer about 3 weeks ago now on a property. We went to see it. It was literally, I think we got there and there was like 5 minutes left of sunlight, and liked the property. We liked the inside and everything like that. So we ended up making an offer, negotiating the property, and eventually got to a price that both the seller and ourselves were comfortable with. And it's so important, guys, to have a financing and a inspection clause. So when we had the inspector go up, he realized because the cottage was on stilts, it actually was started leaning over a little bit and the foundation was becoming a problem. It could have cost us upwards of $40,000 to fix, and it was a well worth $400 to have the inspection clause and the inspector go by and do a thorough inspection before we closed or even firmed our conditions. So, you know, just keep in mind, yes, sometimes there's a lot of different offers or a lot of interest and you want to put an offer that is conditionless, but you definitely don't want that to backfire. And especially for a recreational property, especially for a property, maybe it's your first one, definitely make sure that you don't forego this step because it could have cost us thousands of dollars. So just curious if you guys have any recreational properties right now, and if you guys are renting it on Airbnb or VRBO and how that's working. So I'd love to hear from you guys, as this is going to be my first venture into recreational property. I'm really excited for it. And if you want to email me what your experience is like, or even if you say stay away, it's not a good option, it's not a good idea, I'd love to hear from you guys as well. So my email is sarah@sarahlarby.com, or you guys can go to the contact me page at www.sarahlarby.com. Love hearing from you guys. Keep your questions coming. And if you have 2 seconds, please feel free to rate and review this podcast. So now let's get on with our interview with Dahlia Barsoom. Hi, Dahlia. How are you?
Hey, Sarah. I'm great. Thanks. How are you?
Good, good. I'm so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We've got lots of great things to cover today. And for those of you that don't know, Dahlia is my mortgage broker. And I've met Dahlia about 3 years ago, and she's helped me tremendously be able to scale up my investments. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
So my first question for you is, how did you decide to become a mortgage broker and why?
So I love real estate investing, and I'm an investor myself. And one of the things that I wanted to focus on is financing, because financing is really at the heart of investing. As a mortgage broker, we get to see all aspects of the deal. We get to talk to the realtor, we talk to the lawyer, we talk to the accountant, we talk to the client, to the appraiser, to the lender, sometimes to the contractor. So we get to actually see everything that happens with a deal, which is a lot of fun. The other thing too is a deal can't really happen if the client can't get the money. Clients depend on us to make things happen, and that excites me because sometimes it gets complex and we like to resolve complex scenarios. And yeah, that's part of why I chose to become a mortgage broker, to be part of the deal, to get to see everything and to help the clients out and to solve a complex problem, to get things going and help the client close the deal.
Excellent. How long have you been a mortgage broker for now?
8 years now. I used to work with one of the big five banks for over 17 years in different areas of wealth management, lending, and strategy before I started my business as a mortgage broker. So I've been in this for 8 years as an independent broker. But prior to that, I worked in lending and personal and commercial banking for many years as a corporate employee, basically.
That's great. When I talk to a lot of investors, they have heard of you, they know of you. I mean, you've written a lot of articles and you speak often. How did you decide to work with investors instead of regular home buyers? Or is that something that just fell into place? Because I know that many, many investors are currently working with you.
Yes, that's right. And no, it wasn't actually a coincidence. It started with my experience for my personal portfolio as an investor. And I came across hurdles when I tried to finance my personal properties. And that got me to dig a bit more into the specific topic of how do you actually finance income producing properties, and in particular, how do you do it in a way that helps someone grow a portfolio? Because personally, that's what I wanted to do. So it started with me learning how to do it for myself, and then taking these learnings and providing a service really around it to others who wanted to do the same thing.
And you grew fairly quickly. How did you get so many clients, and how were you able to grow your business that fast?
Two simple things. The first one was getting results. So clients could see working with us that they were getting results. They saw results. We're able to help clients scale. We're able to help clients that came our way who felt they couldn't grow. We help clients who came to us and say, oh, you know what? I don't think I can get anything more done with mortgages. And we helped solve their problems. So getting results became really, we became known for getting results with real estate investors. And that helped spread the word within the investor community very, very quickly. The other thing too is our focus and obsession with client service. We were doing what's right for our clients, not just what's right for our pockets. So sometimes, for example, if we feel that a client is better served somewhere else, we would tell the client, listen, you know what? You should go back to your bank and talk to them about this, this, and that, because this is going to save you money, or this is going to help you do this in a better way. We don't really have to take it on. And being honest with our clients and making sure we do what's best for them also builds a reputation within the investment community that we will truly do what's best for the client. In fact, we just got news that we got nominated. We made it as finalists for a big industry award for the outstanding customer service. So we're very excited about that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Very, very exciting. They will announce the news of the winners on April the 20th. So the combination of both getting results and doing what's right for our clients is what helped us grow pretty fast.
Excellent. So a lot of us are wondering, and myself included, there's a lot of changes that have been happening in this industry for the last couple years, and even more so as of January. What are some of the new changes when it comes to financing that we should be aware of for this year? And do you know if there's other ones coming as well?
Okay, so everybody knows about the January 1st, 2018 stress test, which already kicked in, which entails qualifying at a higher standard, whether you are buying a property for 20% down or whether you're refinancing. So that rule already kicked in. But what we're seeing, we're not expecting any formal guideline changes to come through the system this year from the government or from the regulators. But what we're seeing is that the lenders are becoming a bit more conservative in their lending practices. For example, we may have a deal that could have been easily done with no questions 6 months ago. Numbers work, client is an A client, property is a good property, and everything works. And today, take this deal to the same lender, and what we're getting is a lot of questions. The lender is maybe concerned about the size of the client's portfolio, the pace at which they acquire that portfolio. They want to see a bit more skin in the game. They want to see maybe a cushion in terms of assets to hedge against risk. So we're seeing the lender's posture change when it comes to risk management. Not as much in terms of numbers or ratios or how they qualify deals, but more adding a layer to qualifying a deal that has to do with their comfort level with the risk of the deal. So I think we're going to see a bit more of that in 2018. And what that means for investors is that you need to adjust your expectation as an investor. Not that your deal is going to get declined. It will get approved eventually. You just have to be a bit more patient with the type of paperwork that is required, with answering questions that may come our way from the lenders. So the process is taking a bit longer, especially on larger portfolios, is what we're seeing.
Yes, so that's a great explanation. So I do have a question about that. Are there specific banks or lenders that you're seeing that have made the bigger changes versus others?
No, not really. Pretty much everybody has come out with some sort of a change. I wouldn't say there is one big bank that has changed a lot of things. Everybody has come out with a change in their policy. So, for example, we've seen one known big bank cut down the number of mortgages they finance on investment properties. They used to do up to 10, they cut it to 5. We've also seen some banks tighten the ratios on investment properties. For example, if a client qualified at higher lending ratios in the past, they've cut down how far they would go with these lending ratios going forward. We've also seen lenders, like I said earlier, look for more assets in the client's bank accounts or in net worth to help offset some of their concerns about the risks of rental properties. We've seen lenders raise their rates on rental properties. So everybody came out with something that is, at the end of the day, sending one message. And the message is, we're tightening up our rules. We are being a bit more particular about rental properties because at the end of the day, we investors love rental properties, and we don't see it as risky, as a risky business at all, because we've got great tenants that pay the mortgage. If we lose our jobs, there is a tenant in the property that pays the mortgage, but the banks don't see it the same way. The banks see it as a riskier type of business because there is that's not a roof above our heads. So from their perspective, at the end of the day, all of these changes boil down to one thing, helping them manage their risk. So that's what's happening, and it's pretty consistent across the board. Whether we're talking about A lenders or B lenders, it's pretty much the same. By the end of the day, as investors, we're still able to keep our portfolio going, and we just have to adjust our expectations and work with the new rules, that's all. So planning has become way more important now than the past, just because, again, we're dealing with changes and tighter rules. What I mean by that is, before you go put in your offers, you really want to make sure you've provided all of your documents up front to your mortgage broker, that you have planned exactly how you're going to structure the deal, where's the money going to come from, who's going on title. You really need to answer all of these questions with your mortgage broker ahead of time, ahead of putting an offer. So there is quite a bit of work required before getting to the point of putting an offer from a financing standpoint. And that will help everybody deal with less stress in a way during the process, because if you've got your answers lined up, if you've got your documents lined up, we're able to turn things around much faster when the lenders come and say, hey, what about this? What about that? So that's one thing. The other thing is, of course, having a financing condition in place and giving yourself enough time for that appraiser to go out and to report back the condition of the property and what the property is all about to the lender. So the typical financing condition is 5 business days. And as much as clients come to us and say, hey, you know what, my situation is great and I know what I qualify for based on what we spoke about, can I just go firm on this deal or can I put a 2 days condition? But the reality is, yeah, you know, your finances are great, but still the property has to qualify and the value has to come through and the condition has to be satisfactory to the lender. So give yourself 5 business days condition. So these are the things as an investor that would help you deal with the process in a less stressful way and get things done sooner. So do a lot of the work with your mortgage broker upfront, not during the deal.
Some great advice. Thank you. So one of the things, so we met, I had, I think, 3 properties and I was going directly to the bank at the time. I don't know if you remember this.
We went. Yeah, I remember.
So we bought our first rental and then the second rental, the bank asked us for 25% down because it was our second rental. And then we were going in for our third and they wanted 35% down. And that's where I'm like scratching my head and I'm like, this doesn't really make sense. And then I met you, which is awesome. So the question is, as a new investor wanting to scale up, what does the process look like? What should we be aware of? And how do we allow ourselves to scale up without hitting the financing wall?
Okay, so the comfort zone, like you said, Sarah, is to go and talk to your bank about your next mortgage. That's the comfort zone. That's where typically clients have their first home with their bank and they default to talking to the bank about their next property without really realizing that at the end of the day, a bank or a lender is selling their product, their only product, their guidelines, their product. And their product may not necessarily be the best product for rental properties. Their guideline may not necessarily be the best guidelines for rental properties. So don't assume that everybody else is using the same rules as the bank you're speaking to. That's why it's important to step away and say, okay, I'm going to work with a mortgage broker who understands investment properties and understands all of the rules behind the scene. This way, we can strategically place our deals with the lenders that will give us the best financing and best terms given where we are at our investment journey. So from an investor standpoint, really what you want to do is you want to, again, plan things ahead of time with your mortgage broker. Let your mortgage broker take a look at your income, your credit, your plans. What do you really want to accomplish investing in real estate? Do you want to ultimately replace the income from your job, or do you want to supplement your cash flow, or do you want to build a portfolio to retire on? What's the size of your portfolio? Where is your money going to come from to build this portfolio? All of these things have to be discussed in a very great level of detail upfront. And most importantly, too, for the broker to take a look at all of the supporting documentation that are behind these key things that the lenders will look at when the time comes. So as an investor, it's best to plan it upfront. Yes, you're going to deal with a lot of paperwork, but it's really for your benefit. And by doing so, you're clear, and then you can execute with confidence. And from a financing standpoint, really what we want to accomplish at the end of the day is we want to stretch your portfolio as far as we could with the lenders that will get you into the deal with 20% down, 30-year amortization, give you a great product like an advanceable mortgage product to enable you to access equity down the road and approve you for reasonable financing terms. Before we go to the lenders that will ask you to put 25% down or ask you to cut down on your amortization to 25 years, which would eat into your cash flow, or ask you for higher borrowing costs. So that's basically what it boils down to.
Wow. So a lot of great things, definitely. And the value of using a mortgage broker, I will tell you, I mean, you've saved me thousands of dollars just being able to work and plan properly. And I will say that the goal setting, going through the actual cash flow that we're looking for, I thought I was going to have to get like hundreds of houses. And going through the goals and actually realize that it's only 30, depending on what your cash flow is. I mean, it's different for everybody. I think it was a good eye opener as well, because you may not need as many as you think to get the
exactly
lifestyle you want.
Exactly. And it also depends on the time horizon you're working with. If you're starting early and you've got time on your side, you actually don't need as many properties if your goal is far out versus someone who's starting late, let's say, and they want to achieve a more aggressive cash flow target over a shorter time frame. So it's, to your point, everybody's different, and it's not by the number of properties that you own. It really boils down to what your goal is, what time frame are we working with, and also how much risk are you going to take to achieve such goals. So these are the parameters we typically work with in order for us to fit financing into the bigger picture.
Perfect. So what type of lenders are there out there? I mean, we all know about the big banks, but I'm sure there's a ton more. Can you just do a general overview of what type of lenders exist?
Yeah, so there are four categories of lenders. There is the banks, and the banks represent a group of lenders who would give you typically the best financing terms on your rental property, okay? And then the second bucket is the trust companies. The trust companies, also great lenders. However, the cost of borrowing, working with a trust company, is higher than the bank. So they charge higher interest rates. They may charge something called a lender fee on the deal. However, they do have more flexible rules when it comes to certain situations, specifically for self-employed clients, for rental properties that banks don't want to do, or for trickier deals altogether. We work with them really as a stepping stone or to deal with trickier situations. And then there are the credit unions. Credit unions are somewhere between the banks and the trust companies. The rates are somewhere in between. The rules are stricter than the trust companies, but a bit more lenient than the banks. And then finally, you've got private money. And private money is at the higher end of the scale and is really used as a temporary mechanism to solve a problem if we can't get financing with a bank or a trust company or a credit union. So private money is the most expensive form of money. It is used as a temporary fix, and then we should have an exit strategy for that money ultimately. So these are the four buckets. And as part of portfolio planning, what we want to do is we want to plan the portfolio so that we maximize on the opportunities of working with the group of lenders that will give you the best financing given where you are in your portfolio. So like I said, ideally 20% down, 30-year AM, advanceable mortgage to enable you to reaccess your equity over the long run with reasonable financing terms before we start to go to the next bucket of lenders that charge more, or the next bucket of lenders that want you to inject more into the deal in terms of down payment or cut down your amortization, because all of these things start to change your cash flow and start to change how your financing looks for your next deal as well. So we have to think about what we're getting today, but also how it's going to impact us down the road. So we have to really think 3 to 4 steps ahead in that process, working with these lenders.
Some great advice. Thank you. So I have some friends, actually, I was talking to one yesterday, and they're self-employed, or in this case, this person's a restaurant server, and they have money, but they're wondering how they would go about financing. So if you're self-employed, or you've got a very low income that you're showing, what's your strategy for that?
Okay, so for self-employed clients, I always say, you have to look at the big picture of where you're saving. As self-employed, often clients have a great business makes money, but they don't necessarily pay themselves well at the personal level. So the banks, the first group of lenders, the banks looks at what they pay themselves personally. And often they're not gonna qualify for what they wanna buy working with the banks. But the trust companies would consider what the business generates as income, which is great because at the end of the day, they're going to look at how much deposits you're putting into your business account as self-employed. They're going to take a percentage of these deposits, consider it as your income, although you're really not reporting as much as the personal level. But in return for that, they're going to charge you a higher rate. So as self-employed, you've chosen to save on your taxes. You're going to pay a bit more on the mortgage. But in the bigger scheme of things, if we run the math, you're actually ahead of the game because your overall bill is still less compared to paying yourself more at the personal level, getting taxed on that income to get a, you know, 3% rate. So that's how self-employed should think, or this is how they should think about mortgages. At the end of the day, you're getting a mortgage. Yes, you're paying more, but in the overall, in the bigger scheme of things, you're still saving because you're saving on your taxes. If you're really particular about the rate, which in my view is not the only criteria that investors should really worry about, but if you are, then let's sit down and talk about the income that you should report in 2017 to get your deal to fit into a bank's sandbox. But I guarantee you, once I give you that number, you're going to just laugh at me and say, oh, there is no way I'm going to report all of this. So that's where, again, as an investor, you have to think strategically and you have to take the big picture into consideration. But there are some great options for self-employed clients with the trust companies, with the credit unions. I have self-employed clients who own 20 properties. So is it possible? Absolutely.
Okay, so there's definitely hope for everybody out there. And I'm going to ask you a selfish question because I'm actually looking for a cottage. What does the financing look like on a recreational property or a cottage, or even, you know what, even raw land? How does that work?
Okay, so these are two different things. For cottages, it really boils down to whether the cottage is a four season, which is called all season, or not. If it's an all season cottage, then if you qualify to buy it, like buying any other house, it's looked at as a second home and it's 20% down, 30-year AM, and you will get rates comparable to the type of rates you would get on a primary residence, which are generally cheaper than rates on rental properties. If it's a three seasons cottage, then it gets trickier. And it's really going to boil down to where that cottage is located. But what I can tell you, it's not going to be a 20% down deal. You're going to be expected to inject more into the deal. That percentage will really depend on the local lenders and whether or not they're going to do that type of deal. But I've seen it, you know, anywhere from 30 to 35%. And I've seen lenders say, you know what, we're not going to do an all season, a three seasons cottage, which in that case, you will either have to go private or you may have to rely on line of credit money to buy it out with that money. So it's really on a case-by-case basis of three seasons cottages. As for land, it's a different ball game. If you're buying vacant land and you don't have any construction plans or drawings ready at the time of purchase, so you're not really getting into construction financing, you're just buying the land, you're looking at least a 40% down payment on a vacant land.
So for the cottage piece, you mentioned three seasons, but there is, when we were talking offline, there's a few options where you have some time to turn it into four seasons. Is that correct?
Yes. So if you know what it's going to take to turn that cottage to four seasons, getting into the deal, what we can do is we can go to the lender with a renovations quote that outlines at a very high level what it will take to turn it to a four seasons and the cost associated with it. And we can sign up for a product called Purchase Plus Improvements, and they will basically finance the deal with the condition that you turn it to a four season. So that's a cool product that allows you to get into a three seasons cottage with a bank. Again, they will only go with the four seasons, but giving them a plan up front on what it's going to take to accomplish that will get them to finance the deal if you qualify for it.
Perfect. Thanks for clarifying. So what about flippers, or if there's a house that we want to buy and it just needs a gut job or a huge reno?
Okay, so from a financing standpoint, property represents 50% of the approval. So 50% of the approval is you as an investor, your personal finances, your credit, your income, your net worth, your size of portfolio, down payment, all of that stuff. The other 50% is the property. So that what that really means is we're talking here about property condition, property location. So if the condition is run down, the financing is going to vary. Meaning, if you're buying something that just is just outdated, requires lipstick renovations. It is still livable. It is rentable, but it just looks a bit tired. That's a property that a bank would work with, assuming there are no other major issues related to knob and tube or asbestos or oil tanks, okay? If the property, however, is run down, meaning that it's not livable and requires work, where the deal is going to go depends on the extent of the work. So if it's just run down, we know that there are some holes here and there, requires work, most likely the banks will not touch it unless we go into the deal under a purchase plus improvement strategy. So we go to the bank and say, hey, listen, guys, here's what we're planning on doing for this property. Here is the list. Here is what it's going to cost us. And the bank will say, okay, knowing that you're going to improve it, we'll do the deal with that condition in mind. So that's one way. If the bank says no under a purchase plus improvements product, then we take it to the next group of lenders, which is the trust companies. And that's where the trust companies would work with a property that the bank doesn't want to touch. However, they're going to ask you to inject a bit more into the deal. So instead of the 20% down, you may have to put 30, or you may have to put 35% down. The cool thing about the trust companies, though, is that they will allow you to put secondary financing behind their mortgages. So you can really structure the deal in a way where you don't have to tie so much capital to the property, because you're going to need, you need money at hand to renovate it. We go to the trust companies. Again, they're going to charge you higher rates. However, we know it's going to be a very short-term thing. Once you're done the renovations, you're going to flip it, or you're going to refinance it back to a bank. If the property is completely trash and it's in a really, really rough shape, and the trust company doesn't want to touch it, even with more skin in the game, the bank doesn't want to touch it, even under purchase plus improvements, your only option would be to go to a private lender. A private lender is going to do it, almost guaranteed to do it. They will charge you a lot of money, but again, it's the cost of doing business if you're into the renovation strategy. It's going to be short term. You finish the reno, we turn around, switch it back to a bank, or you sell it and pay out the private. So these are the three flavors of renovation and financing on a rundown property.
So you mentioned private money a couple of times. As a new investor, somebody that's doing this for the first time, how do they go about finding it if the banks turn them down as well as the trust companies?
Through the mortgage broker. We do have access to a lot of private money.
Okay, perfect. That's great. And so I wanted to ask you about commercial financing. Obviously, it's a whole different ballgame. Would you mind just giving a general overview of how it's different and how the lending process works?
Yeah, so the key difference between commercial financing and residential, and let me actually start by clarifying what commercial financing mean and what residential financing means. Residential financing applies when you're buying anything that is 1 to 4 units. So a single family home, duplex, triplex, fourplex. There is also a very, very small universe of lenders out there that would consider a 5 and a 6 unit residential, believe it or not. But anything generally above 4 units is considered commercial financing. The key difference between how financing works in residential versus commercial is who qualifies for the loan. In the residential space, you as an investor are qualifying for the loan. The lender is going to look at your credit. They're going to look at your income. They're going to look at your ability to service the loan. They're going to look at your net worth. They're going to look at all sorts of things. And at the end of the day, see if you would be able to get a loan based on their guidelines. In the commercial world, it's the property that qualifies. So the lenders look at the property as if it's a business. The property is the main applicant for the loan. They're going to look at this business and say, okay, this is a 5-plex. Each unit is renting for, I don't know, $1,200. Let's take that rent into consideration. Let's look at the expenses. And at the end of the day, we're going to arrive to something called net operating income. Is this net operating income sufficient to actually carry the loan? And how much can it carry? So that's the thinking they go through when they issue a commercial approval. It's really the property that qualifies. I have clients who have zero income personally, zero, but they're able to get commercial financing because it's the property that's qualifying. That client is to go and buy a residential property. They're not going to be able to qualify for anything because they're showing zero income. But because they're applying under commercial, they're still able to grow. So these are the two key distinctions. Who qualifies for the deal? Also, generally speaking, in commercial, your down payment is higher. You're looking at 25% down on something that got residential units to it. So a multi-residential or a mixed-use property is 25% down. Amortization is also shorter. It's 25 years. If you're buying something that is all commercial, so all retail space, they're going to shorten your amortization to 20 years. There is a product out there that is a cool product for commercial properties with CMHC that allows the client to get extended amortization at 30 years, also allows lower rates, enables lower rates. However, it is a much more time-consuming process to work with CMHC. And for those who have invested in commercial, what CMHC may see as a value, which is what they're going to lend against, could be different than what you're actually buying the property for. So there are sometimes discrepancies in values when we go down the CMHC route. So these are the key differences. The other one is that in commercial, they don't care whether you're buying it under a corporation. In fact, it's preferred to buy a property under a corporation in the commercial world.
That's a great point. So if we were to buy a commercial property, and I'm assuming that it's definitely a lot more time than the typical standard residential time frame, would you recommend that investors ask for time frames?
So on commercial properties, we recommend 30 days financing condition. That is a 3-0 compared to the 5 business days financing condition, because the appraiser is going to take 2 to 2.5 weeks to come out and put the report together. Then from that point on, the lender actually goes through the process of an approval. They're not going to issue an approval for you upfront, conditional on appraisal and conditional on this and that, like residential. They issue something called the letter of interest, which says, we like this deal. Here is what we're willing to offer. Let's get the process going. And here are the terms. That's what they issue upfront. It's not an approval. It's called the letter of interest. But once the appraiser goes out and generates the report, which takes 2 to 2.5 weeks, the lenders then review that report. Again, that's really a big determinant of whether or not they're going to lend on the property, because that report is very comprehensive. It outlines the net operating income, everything that lenders want to see relating to that particular property. And then from there, they're going to look at all of your other documents and issue an approval. So you really need to plan 30 days, and that's the norm for a financing condition on commercial. Then you need to plan for another 3 to 4 weeks to close after that.
Excellent. Thank you. You mentioned incorporating. When's a good time, according to a mortgage broker, for somebody to incorporate? And then I guess we can do it for residential and then also for commercial.
So for commercial, always go under a corporation. Always. Because it doesn't impact your financing. There is no trade-off, is what we call it. Whether you put it under a corporation or your personal name, from a commercial lending standpoint, you're going to get the same terms, you're going to get the same down payment, you're going to get the same rates. There is no trade-off. On the residential side, the story is a bit different. There is no black or white rule as to when to put a property under a corporation. It really boils down to where you are with your investment portfolio and what do you qualify for at that point in time. So the general rule of thumb is, if we feel there is a trade-off when we're financing a deal of putting it under a corporation, we would recommend that you take it on personally. And by a trade-off, I mean the following. If we take it under a corporation, you may need to put in a higher down payment, or we may need to shorten amortization, or your rate may be higher, or you may need to give away an advanceable mortgage feature. These are trade-offs. If you're willing to trade off something to put it under a corporation, then let's do it that way. But if you want the key things that we consider favorable for real estate investors, and you want all of them, you may have to put it under your personal name at that point in time. If there is no option to obtain these key favorable things while putting it under the corp. So that's really what it boils down to. There will come a point in your real estate portfolio where there is no trade-off. And typically, it's after the 10th property. We've seen it earlier. Again, depending on the investor's finances, but between the 6th to the 10th property onward, we've seen less of concerns regarding trade-offs. And often we're able to put it under a corporation because we're able to get the client the same term going either way. But again, each individual investor's finance is different. Accountant as a lawyer will tell you all the time, you know, go the corporate way. But from a financing standpoint, that's what we look at. Is there a trade-off or not at that point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so individual. I have a lot of people asking me if we incorporate and why and when and if they should. I'm like, it's really individual. You can't just, it's not a one size fits all type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, the lawyer and accountant can answer this question in a much clearer way, because the lawyer is going to say, oh, from a liability standpoint, you know, a corporation may serve you better. The accountant may say, from an accounting standpoint, there may be benefits and it's going to serve you better. But from a financing standpoint, I can't tell you, oh, you should incorporate all the time or not, or you should incorporate at the third property versus the fourth property. It's really on a case-by-case basis.
Excellent. So I do want to congratulate you on being a best-selling author. And you wrote a book that I really enjoyed reading called The 7 Secrets of Getting All the Money That You Want. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and what some of the secrets might be?
Yeah, so the book basically covers a broad spectrum of topics that are relevant to real estate investors, from giving you an idea about the lenders that are out there, what they look for, how to better be prepared, give you some tips and tricks relating to how you structure your deals and the sources of funding available to you. If you want to know the secrets, at the end of the day, in my view, the biggest secret of successfully financing a portfolio is planning the financing. As much as there are a lot of options available out there, it's a really complex world, and there are a lot of rules behind the scenes that investors wouldn't know if they're not in the day-to-day business of working with the lenders and dealing with income property. So the biggest secret to getting your portfolio structured correctly from a financing standpoint to continue to grow is to plan it ahead of time with a mortgage broker that knows these rules inside out. And that's been my personal experience too, really, in building my portfolio. Because now I know all of the rules, I've personally benefited from structuring my own portfolio and doing what I do for my clients for myself. So that's really the biggest secret of financing a portfolio.
Thank you so much for that. What's the next chapter for you, and what are some of your goals moving forward?
That's a tough question. From a business standpoint, we really want to continue to grow our advisor base at Streetwise Mortgages. We want to increase our reach, continue to increase our reach to working with real estate investors and service investors. So we're working on growing our advisor base. We're also looking to augment the types of services that we offer with tools and resources that will help investors plan better and continue to grow. So these are the two key goals from a business standpoint. From a personal standpoint, if you're asking about investing,
yeah,
I have two kids. I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, and I am planning to acquire some properties to basically support their future education. So from an investing standpoint, your goals are always changing, and you have to question what purpose is a particular property in your portfolio is serving? Is that property there to eventually pay itself down and generate the cash flow for you in retirement? Or is that property there to help pick up momentum for you because it's a really, it's an aggressive growth market and eventually you will sell it and pay down mortgages? I am at that point personally right now. I'm questioning what purpose are properties playing in my portfolio. And what I've come to the realization, it's not a surprise, but I've built a portfolio that I'm going to retire on, but I need to supplement that portfolio with some additional properties that will help us as parents fund our kids' education when the time comes. And the criteria for selecting such properties is going to be a bit different than the criteria we use to acquire properties that will be cash cows by the time we retire. So that's on the personal side what I'm looking at right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm a big proponent of buying rental properties or investment properties for kids instead of tax-free savings accounts. I think it goes a long way. So the next part of the podcast is called the lightning round, and you're going to get a series of 5 questions and just give me the first answer that comes to your head within 30 seconds. Are you ready?
Ready. Yep.
Okay. So question number 1 of the lightning round, what is your favorite real estate investing book ever?
The best real estate book that I've read and resonated with me is More Than Cash Flow by Julie Broad.
Excellent. Do you listen to podcasts or any audiobooks or anything like that?
Yes. My favorite podcast is Where to Invest by a lady named Sarah Larby.
Okay. So 3, what's your favorite pastime? So what do you do for fun when you're not doing real estate?
Well, what I do for fun is I try to seek things that are a bit more on the relaxing side because our business is very, very demanding and very fast-paced. So what I tend to do is activities with the kids, walk my dog, listen to Latin music. I really love Latin music. And on the active side, I play soccer.
Excellent. Perfect. And if you lost all your money tomorrow and your assets, how would you start again?
First of all, I think if you have the drive and determination to succeed, you're going to figure out a way regardless. What I would first do probably is find a quick way to just generate income by working, I guess, to meet the necessities of paying bills and bringing food on the table. While from a long-term standpoint, what I would do is still going to be real estate related. And it's likely going to be going through joint ventures and trying to work with others to grow in an accelerated fashion to rebuild wealth that way, not just for myself again, but for the partners I'll be working with. So it would be I would take these two paths. I would find a way to generate income just to meet the day-to-day necessities. But from a long-term standpoint, it's going to be, again, real estate, and very likely it's going to be joint ventures because it's one way, in my view, to accelerate your plans. But you really need to know why you're doing it. It's not just a strategy you incorporate because it sounds cool.
Great advice. And so question 5, so if somebody has $50,000 that they've saved and they want to get started, how would you recommend that they spend it?
Buy something. Buy a property. I would say see where you can buy a property with that amount of down payment. It may be a bit more remote because properties have gotten more expensive. And of course, if you choose to go down that route, you really need to know what you're buying and whether it's going to rent or not. I'm not just saying take that money and buy a property and that's it. Just make sure you still do your homework, but take a step forward and own something, because that ownership is going to serve you well down the road. That's what's going to help your money grow. That's what's going to help you get your fingers wet. That's typically the biggest hurdle, is to start. That's one way. The other way is basically growing this money. So you can take this $50,000 and get into a strategy. If you're a handyman or a renovator, and it's not for everybody, get into a strategy where you can grow that capital. If you take that $50,000, buy a property that you renovate, force value through this process, then turn around and sell it or refinance it if you qualify to extract out your money, now you can actually rinse and repeat. So one way is to say, if you have the skills, get into a strategy that will help you grow that capital. One of them is renovating and forcing value through, or even rent to own, you know, is another strategy that you can utilize to grow that capital. Private mortgage is also a third one. So one way is to say, let's grow that money. And once we grow that money, buy something with it. And one way is to go buy something with it. Even if it's small, it's still a step forward that will help you move forward. I wouldn't suggest joint ventures as a first move with that money. I wouldn't. Because if you're starting out, there is a lot for you to learn. And to add a layer of complexity by working with a partner, again, everybody's different, but that's what I've seen works best. If you're starting out, be in control, learn from others and work from others and get coached and learn as much as you can, but to tie hips with someone on your first deal may not be the best way to go. Maybe on your second deal once you're a bit more experienced, but not on the first one with this money, with this capital, if it's your only capital.
Yeah, thank you for that. I do agree. If they have the $50,000, there's definitely a lot of opportunities that they can buy something and learn that way. So where can listeners find you if they wanted to reach out to you and know more about you?
Well, we're very reachable. They can visit us at www.streetwisemortgages.com, learn a bit more about what we do. We do have a contact form there that clients can complete if they have questions or if they would like to set up a complimentary consultation, which we don't charge for. They can also email us at info@streetwisemortgages.com with attention to Dahlia, and I will respond.
Perfect. And final question, any last words of advice or anything else that you'd like to let listeners know about?
I would say there's been a lot of panic in regards to the new rules that kicked in January. And a lot of clients felt that the sky is falling and this is the end of owning rental properties. And there was a lot of panic from November to January. I just want to put things in perspective for everybody. Yes, the rules have changed. They will continue to change. The lenders will change. But that's always the case with real estate. There will always change. And we'll all adjust to change. And at the end of the day, people still want to invest. People still want to buy. So things are still doable. It's just that you have to plan things ahead of time. Maybe we need to take a look at your finances and say, you know what, in order to get your next deal done, we need to pay something off, or we need to shovel something around when it comes to your debt, or we need to work with you as a self-employed client to show more income this year to make the deal work. That's where the conversation comes in to help you understand how to manage this change and be in control of your finances to work with these changes. This way, you can keep things going. So all I want to share with clients is that the sky is not falling. All we need to do is adjust our methods and work with the right professionals to help us navigate through these new rules. But financing is still happening. Clients are still growing. Clients are still buying. Things are still the same, in my view. It's a bit tougher with paperwork, but in my view, it's still a great environment to still buy real estate, grow your portfolio, and the rates are still relatively low, although they've increased. But because we all got so spoiled by free money, we're seeing them as expensive now. But at the bigger scheme of things, the rates are very, very low. And if you're buying rental properties that are borderline with the numbers because the rate has increased by 20 basis points, then you shouldn't buy that rental property to start. okay? It's not the rate. The problem is not the rate. The problem is the property or the strategy. So things are still working. Investors are still growing. Just put things in perspective, plan better, and you will continue to be successful, and you'll be able to still acquire what you want to acquire and get to your goal.
Amazing. So on that note, Dahlia, I will say that you've helped me tremendously. So thank you for all your help throughout the years of my investing career. Great, great advice. And I will see you at the investor forum where you're speaking.
Yes, Sarah. Thank you. I am looking forward to actually listening to your presentation. And I did enjoy very much working with you and seeing you succeed.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for being on Where Should I Invest? See you next time.
See you. Have a great day.
Thanks so much for listening to Where Should I Invest with your host, Sarah Larbee. Make sure to listen in next time. We'll catch you on the next episode of Where Should I Invest?